mind, since I guess probably most people haven't been following this that carefully. And I designed my talk to be sort of modular so that if people are interested in things and want to ask more about it, it's okay. I can sort of shift things around later to depending on what I want to get to. So please don't hesitate to ask questions. Okay, so I'll begin by just very briefly giving one version of the AMPS argument, where AMPS is Almiry, Meroff, Polchinski, and Sully. So these are some folks who have argued that the black hole horizons are not smooth, at least for old enough black holes. So their argument is based on attempting to use quantum mechanics to describe the observations of an observer who's falling into a black hole. So we can describe the situation via Penrose diagram like that. So this is some evaporating Schwarzschild black hole. Here's the horizon. And then we're interested in some observer who conventionally is called Alice, I guess, who falls into the black hole. Okay, some people have complained that Alice and Bob are too Eurocentric and that this should be called Ahmed, but that'll get confusing if I do that. And what we're interested in is, well, roughly we think that there should be some time slice like that, and then Alice can sort of view her physics as evolving on time slices like this. Maybe I'll make it purple just so that this, well, purple doesn't look that different from white. Okay. And then the way that the argument works is you say that on this kind of slice, at least approximately, you should be able to think of some state in a Hilbert space where the structure of the Hilbert space, at least away from these horizons, is well described by effective field theory. So this is some sort of approximate validity of local physics in the bulk, as understood by Alice, who's falling into the black hole. And we'll see about, you know, to what extent we really need this local field theory assumption. I should say, though, that assuming that the state here can be described by local field theory, approximately, is different from saying that the state can be computed from local field theory. So let me give an example. If you have a black hole which you form out of some scattering process and then you wait for it to evaporate, we think that at late times after the evaporation, the state of the system will just be some state in the Fock space of the radiation field. You know, we think the labels on the S matrix are the labels you get out of effective field theory. So the state at late times is well described by effective field theory. But of course, which state it is, to know that, you have to know quantum gravity. You have to be able to turn the incoming state into the outgoing state. So that's really sort of the main assumption that goes into these kinds of arguments, is that somehow, even though we don't have a in principle way of knowing what the state is, we think that some state should exist that Alice can use to understand observations on this kind of slice, at least approximately. Yeah.
Is as long as your effective field theory was valid in the entire regime, and of course in the case of the evaporating black hole, that's not true.
Yeah.
You at some point, or like near the Big Bang,
yeah,
some point where your effective field theory is clearly breaking down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't need to assume that. I mean, I'm not going to need to assume that I could get this state from effective field theory to get a contradiction. So I mean, we don't need to worry too hard about whether we can. It's just enough to say that some state like this should exist is enough to get you into trouble. So how does that work? Well, I'll maybe say this a little bit more carefully in a little bit, but the way that the AMPS argument works is you focus on some mode of the field, which is here just inside the horizon on this slice, some other mode of the field here, which is on just outside of the horizon on this slice, and then you have the radiation field down here, which is sort of the Hawking radiation that has come out so far. And then the claim is that, if the black hole is old, where old means that the coarse grain entropy in the radiation is bigger than the entropy of the remaining black hole, then unitarity implies that B is entangled. I don't really know what the best way to indicate it is, so I'll just write it like that. It is entangled with some subfactor R sub B of the radiation. Or in other words, the purification of B in the state here is out in the radiation. And I'll say a little bit more about why we think that's true in a minute. But then smooth horizon implies that A and B have to be entangled, at least for a judicious choice of A and B. And these can't both be true. They can't both be true. It violates what people sometimes call monogamy of entanglement. And we can say it, I mean, one way to make that precise is by using strong subadditivity applied to these three subfactors of the Hilbert space. And I should say that's where effective field theory goes in, is indeed in assuming that these are distinct subfactors. What strong subadditivity says is this. And then we claim that unitarity tells you that this is zero, okay? And then that tells you that this is just SA. And then this tells you that the mutual information is less than or equal to zero between A and B. But of course, since the mutual information is positive, that means that it's zero, which means that there can't be any entanglement of any kind between A and B. So that's the contradiction is that of amps, is that there's two things that you want to both be true, and no state that you could assign to this slice, no matter where you got the state from, would be able to have both of these things true. Okay, let's see if I can. So a common comment about this is if the assumption is correct, then this is mathematics. I mean, the conclusion is correct. So then the question is, clearly if we don't want to buy the conclusion, which is that we either have to give up unitarity or a smooth horizon, then we have to give up the assumption that went into the structure of the Hilbert space. And you might say, well, we already know that, slices that go behind horizons aren't supposed to be described by effective field theory. I mean, Hawking's original argument for a unitarity violation was based on considering these so-called nice slices, which do that. And then the argument was that, whatever you made the black hole out of is sitting here. And then if information is coming out in the Hawking radiation, then the information is also here. And then that's cloning, because, whatever you could have, this is a machine for throwing in whatever you want here and then finding it both here and here. And the usual argument, the usual reply to Hawking's argument is that, that's true, but nobody can ever see the cloning. So this is the sort of complementarity argument from the 90s, is that, the information comes out late enough that by the time you get it, if you want to turn around and jump into the black hole, you're jumping in way up here. And you just, the amount of time that you get to see this for is, very sub-Planckian. You can't really resolve it. So somehow, the cloning, you can't really realize the cloning on this slice within the past light cone of a single observer. So then the sort of ideology was that we can resolve Hawking's contradiction by just focusing on what's observable to a single observer. So the new thing in amps is that even if you do that, there's still a problem. And that's what this picture is designed to show, is that here we've just focused on things that at least by causality, are accessible to Alice, and we've still uncovered a contradiction. So that's the new feature that was not there 6 months ago. Yeah. What? Oh, yeah. So this is the von Neumann entropy. Yeah. So okay, good. So R is the radiation, and I claimed that B is, well, close to maximally entangled with the radiation. What? Oh, good. So the Hilbert space has some factorization, which is HA times HB times HR times, you know, whatever other things. Okay. So when you compute the reduced density matrix, you can compute the reduced density matrix on two of the subfactors at once. So actually what happened here was then I further factorized HR into HR sub B times, HR other. And then I just computed the reduced density matrix for the factors B and R sub B, and then computed its von Neumann entropy. No, it's not the sum of the two entropies. It's the trace of rho log rho for rho b r sub b. And since there's entanglement, it's definitely not the sum of the two entropies. In fact, it's zero, whereas both of the entropies are the logs of the Hilbert space dimension. Okay. So the talk I'm giving here is based on a paper with Patrick Hayden, who I guess spends some of his time around here. And what we argued is that even though, these three different things are all causally in the same Hilbert space, or in the same light cone, actually still you can't actually, no one observer can access all of them. And so previously the reasons that no one could access all of them had to do with causality. But here, what we'll argue is that it has to do with computational complexity. Roughly, the purification of B, this R sub B, the factor of R that's entangled with B. If we fix B, if we pick some B near the horizon, which is easy to measure, then its purification will be some very complicated subfactor of the radiation Hilbert space from the point of view of doing local experiments on the radiation. And one will have to work hard to extract the subspace R sub B, or subfactor R sub B, out of the radiation. So then, if that's true, then you can have a kind of complementarity going on. So Alice, who stays in, can see A and B, but can't see R sub B. Whereas Charlie, someone who stays outside, can see B and R sub B, because Charlie is outside, so he can decode all he likes, but he's not able to see R because it's behind the horizon. Provided that I can argue that if Alice tries to decode R sub B out of R, by the time she's done, say the black hole have already evaporated. Okay, so, say I can show that that's true. Then we can see maybe what could be going on is that from Charlie's point of view, B and R sub B are entangled as required by unitarity, whereas from Alice's point of view, A and B are entangled so that we have a smooth horizon. And there's no contradiction because none of them can actually try and test both of the entanglements at the same time and verify that there's a contradiction. So that would be a sort of a new kind of complementarity. So let me say that a little bit more quantitatively. So just for a Schwarzschild black hole in four dimensions, the von Neumann entropy is proportional to the mass squared, the evaporation time. This is in Planck units. The evaporation time is proportional to the mass cubed. Adopting a sort of computer science notation, we can call that n. And then in order to be able, for Alice to be able to test the entanglement between B and R sub B before jumping into the black hole, we need the time for her to do the computation or to we'll see soon that computation is the right word, needs to be less than the evaporation time, which is n to the 3/2. And that's fast. I mean, most computations, you can't do that fast. I mean, OK, say you want to multiply two n by n matrices with order one components. That takes n cubed naively. And if you're smart, it takes n to the 2.3. And I think people have even showed that no algorithm can do it faster than n squared log n, which is still faster than this. So in order for Alice to be able to do this experiment, I mean, the decoding has got to be really easy. It's got to be easier than multiplying two matrices. Now, actually, what Patrick and I argue is that actually, so this does not happen. And what happens instead is that the time to do the computation is exponential in n. Okay, so it's not even close to these sort of low kind of powers. Now, okay, the analysis I gave here was just for a Schwarzschild black hole in four dimensions. One could consider more general kinds of black holes and see if you could come up with some kind of situation where the evaporation time was exponential in the entropy. And indeed, there are some kinds of situations you can come up with, although it's actually pretty hard to come up with one that doesn't have other problems. But yeah, even in those situations, it seems that, well, although it's exponential, it's sort of a lower exponential than this exponential, although it's hard to really be precise about that. But at worst, you can sort of get order of magnitude. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so there's a, in order to say this more precisely, I need a, I'm going to introduce a model of this, just so that we can have something concrete to talk about in trying to make this argument. And in the model, some of the statements I made before, like the entanglement up there, should be clear about why those statements are true. So since I'm going to try and argue that decoding R sub b is hard, I mean, that's something that someone who stays outside of the black hole and never jumps in can do. So I'm going to give the discussion from the point of view of Charlie, of someone who stays outside. And then if it's hard for Charlie to do the coding, then it's also hard for Alice, but it'll just make it'll make the notation a little bit more pleasant. So let's just think about Charlie for a sec. So Charlie does physics on slices like that, because Charlie can't see behind the horizon. And in order to make the sort of, you know, to work in this sort of amps kind of framework of these approximately effective field theory Hilbert spaces, what we can do is we can say that, well, the Hilbert space, according to Charlie, it factorizes into three factors, which I'll call B, H, and R. And then the interpretations of these factors. Well, this B, we can think of it as like the atmosphere of the black hole, where if you want to think in Schwarzschild coordinates, it's like you know, in between 2gm plus epsilon. And say 3gm. So these are the modes that are confined to be near the black hole, and they're roughly, they behave like Rindler space. Then H, we can think of as the sort of horizon. So these are the, this is really just for intuition. These are the R's, which are in between the horizon and sort of 2gm plus epsilon, where epsilon is some Planckian thing. So these we don't expect to be well described by effective field theory. These are the things that are sort of very close to the horizon, so they're very redshifted from the point of view of someone outside, but actually if you look locally, you're looking at high energy physics. So this is just some, this is usually called the stretched horizon when you're thinking about black hole physics. It's kind of the repository of the microstates, sort of the counting of the entropy of the black hole. And then finally, this is the radiation. So this is, you know, say R greater than 3GM. Okay, and I mean, and clearly the details of how I do this decomposition don't really matter. It's just kind of the, you know, just to get some general idea. Okay, so now let's say that the black hole is old. What old means is that it's evaporated enough that there's sort of more entropy here, more coarse-grained entropy in the radiation than there is in the remaining black hole system. So, you know, we could draw a picture where here I'm sort of drawing coarse-grained entropies, and R is here, and B and H are here. So then, well, there's a theorem about what happens in these kinds of situations, which is that you typically expect, if you have a bipartite Hilbert space and one of the factors is smaller, then for most states, the smaller factor is maximally entangled with some subfactor of the larger factor. So this was the thing I used up there before. And we can write that quantitatively in the following. We can say that the state of the system, or I'll put it, this is just some normalization factor. Okay, so we can write the state like this. So let me explain the symbols. So this is just some basis for the atmosphere where I'll take the basis to be something that is a sensible basis from the point of view of local physics. You know, I don't know, a photon here, a photon there. H is just some basis for the stretched horizon. It's just some basis. I don't have any idea what a preferred basis might be. And then this basis for the radiation is some local accessible basis. And then this UR is going to be the star of the show today. So for most of the rest of the talk, we're just going to be discussing the properties of this U sub R. This U sub R is the unitary transformation on the radiation, which takes you from the physically local basis to what's usually called the Schmidt basis. I guess most people here know about the Schmidt basis. So if I'd covered this up, then this would have been what's usually called the Schmidt decomposition of the state, where the entanglement is completely obvious. And then here you just do some basis change to get to the basis which is physically reasonable. So, I mean, to the extent that it's hard for someone outside to check the entanglement between the atmosphere and the radiation, it's the extent to which this UR is complicated. Okay. So, in particular, if you want to undo the scrambling of the radiation, your job is to act with UR dagger on the radiation, okay? And so then the question is, for the rest of the talk, is how long does it take to act with UR dagger? You know, does it, I mean, I'm going to argue that it takes an exponential amount of time. Okay. So yeah, this task of, you know, you have some system and you want to act on it with your favorite unitary transformation is of course just quantum computation. I mean, that's what people mean by quantum computation, is you pick your favorite unitary and you act with it on some space. And there's a standard model of how hard it is to do a quantum computation. So for the quantum information people, sorry, you can go to sleep for 5 minutes. And wake up, and I'll be done. And I'm going to talk about the circuit model now. So the standard model is called the quantum circuit model. It's a way of building unitaries on a large space out of unitaries on smaller pieces of the space. And it's usually taken to give a good sense of how hard it is to do a computation. So I'll introduce it, and then we can afterwards discuss a little bit whether or not this model is really a good measure in this situation of how hard it is to do the computation. So yeah, the way it works is you imagine, okay, you have say n qubits, where here n is 4, And then the idea is to build up the complicated unitary by just acting with unitaries just on two qubits at a time. And so the ones you act with two at a time are usually called gates. So for example, okay, here's something that you can do with three gates. Of course, usually it's not assumed that you can only apply on neighbors, so there could be a gate that just acts on these two. And then, so the whole collection of gates together is called a circuit, and then the complexity of doing the computation is usually, well, at least one good measure of it is the size of the circuit, which means how many of these gates you need to make it. So, okay, it's an interesting theorem, which is that, any unitary you can make in this way, okay? And in fact, you can make any unitary, even if there's only a finite set of these two qubit operations that you're allowed to apply. And actually, in fact, one is enough. If you choose a generic element of U4, which is the set of operations on two qubits, then as long as you're allowed to apply that on any two of the qubits in any order, you can get any unitary transformation. So that's sort of the point of universal quantum computation. So the question now is, how many gates does it take in general to make a complicated unitary? That's kind of the question we're after. How many gates do we need? And there's a simple way to estimate how many you need. So the way it works is, let's first say that we have T gates. You can ask how many circuits can we make? How many different unitary transformations can we make? And then once T is big enough that you can get all the unitaries, then you know that gives you a sense of how many you need to make a typical unitary. And this is easy to check. So, for each gate, you've got an n choose two to decide which two guys you act on. And then you've got a two because the order matters. I said you could have one fundamental gate. You could also have two or three. There's various sets. So let's just say F, some finite number of fundamental gates that doesn't scale with N. And then there's just that many circuits. Okay, so we need to make that choice for each of the gates in the circuit. Of course, these aren't all necessarily distinct, but that will just make T even larger, and we're really just trying to hit a lower bound on how many gates we need. So we could say this is the number of gates. And then what we want to compare this to is the number of unitary transformations, which of course is infinite because the unitary group is continuous. So you have to discretize the unitary group in some way. You have to sort of introduce some epsilon that tells you sort of how close do you want to get to some unitary before you're satisfied. So what that means more practically, we can modify the unitary, we can sort of, to a crude approximation, so we're interested in elements of U 2 to the n. This is the set of unitaries acting on n qubits. And we can very crudely model this as a cube in R 2 to the 2n, because the dimensionality of this group is just the square of 2 to the n, okay? And it's a compact group, so we can just think of it as some cube of finite size in R 2 to the 2n. Let's say that to get the so that then the linear distance in here we can use to define balls of radius epsilon, and then we can just ask how many balls of radius epsilon do we need to cover this cube, and that'll give us a good sense of sort of how many different unitaries there are that are distinguishable to within distance epsilon. Okay, and that's easy to do. So the number is just epsilon. The number of unitaries is epsilon to the minus 2 to the 2n, to sort of in the most crude approximation. Okay, so then we just equate these two numbers, and we find that the number of gates is 2 to the 2n times log of 1 over epsilon. Okay. Because the epsilon appears in the log here, it doesn't really matter that I gave such a crude picture of the unitary group here. I mean, probably a better definition would have involved various polynomials of 2 to the n time going into the definition of epsilon, but since there's a log here, those aren't going to change the leading scaling here. Okay, so good. This, what this means is that if we have to make UR this way, then if we don't know anything else about UR, we're going to have to assume that it's going to take this many gates to make it, and then the statement will be true. So let me just comment about a few ways you could try to fix this. Okay, so technically, here I was computing the time, and here I was computing the number of gates. So if you can act with more than one gate at once, you could try and speed this up by parallelization. But it's fairly clear that, I mean, you'd have to act with exponentially many of them at once in order to try and beat down this exponential. So you'd have to parallelize to an exponential size of your computer. And then just, I mean, communicating between one side of your computer and the other would take exponential time. So that by itself wouldn't be enough to beat this. A more serious objection, I think, is, here I was assuming that the computation is done using sort of local low energy physics. You know, we sort of wander around from one piece of the computer to another. And of course, when you're trying to make a quantum computer in a lab, that's a good thing to assume. But here we're really talking about questions of principle. So you might think, okay, well, so the sort of usual quantum circuit computer isn't able to do this fast enough. But say that you just, you know, you say you had some black hole and you spent like a really, really long time preparing that black hole in some really crazy state. You know, some state, I mean, because, you know, you have, before Alice jumps in, she's got all the time in the world to prepare her computer. So can she somehow use that to beat this by carefully preparing the state of the computer? Naively it's unclear whether she should be able to or not. But actually the answer is no. So let me just say a little bit about why the answer is no to that question. So what do you need? I mean, you want some computer such that when you adjoin the computer to the radiation and you let them evolve dynamically, that the natural dynamics just do the computation for you. I mean, of course, that's always what a computer is doing, but usually we don't talk about it in such a silly way because we understand the dynamics of the computer better. But if it's some black hole, if it's some complicated thing, then maybe we don't understand it better. So let me say that. We want the time evolution of the computer to be such that it takes states UR times BH0 in the radiation, time some state in the computer. So C here is going to be the Hilbert space of the computer. And it evolves that state to something which depends on B and H, times B, where, say, this is just the I should have defined this earlier. In this factorization, I'll take this to be K qubits, and this to be N qubits, and this to be M. Okay. So then this B here is the first K qubits of the memory. Okay. And if I can find some state of the computer where the evolution does this, then I'll have succeeded in doing some sort of crazy black hole exotic computation that can beat the circuit model. Now, of course, if you just, I mean, here I picked a particular state, and if you just pick a particular state, then it's very unlikely that the first state you pick is going to be the one that actually does the computation you want. So the real question is there any initial state of this computer that I can pick? If I sort of, you know, by considering all the different initial states, will I be able to find even one where the dynamics does this? Okay, and what I'll sketch now is an argument that you can't, and that actually the probability of being able to find any state of the computer that works is ridiculously small. So how does that work? I mean, you just, to compute that probability, what you want is you want the number of states of the computer this is for all B and H here. So then the number of somethings divided by the full number of of states in R and C, okay, raised to the B times H. So let's just unpack this a little bit. So the thing, right? So you want it to do this, but you don't care what the something is. So for if you fix this state, then the probability that the dynamics will do what you want is just 1 over the total number of states that you could have gotten out here if you have no idea. So that's what this denominator is. But then of course you don't care what the something is. So you're happy with any something. So you get to multiply this by here. You want it to be true for all B's and H's. So that's what this is. And then you get to multiply by the number of different states that you can consider for the computer. How shall I say this? Of course, again, we have the problem we ran into with the unitary group, which is that I'm talking about the number of states in the Hilbert space, and the Hilbert space is infinite because it's continuous. So again, I need to discretize the Hilbert space in some way to get a sense of sort of how many different states are there in a Hilbert space of dimension D, which are distinguishable within some epsilon. So again, there's a standard construction of this. The sort of good way of distinguishing states is called the trace norm. And so you can construct what's called an epsilon net, which is just a finite set of states in the Hilbert space such that any state is within distance epsilon of one of those states. Okay, and then that's a good definition of a discretization of the Hilbert space. To get a sense of how many of those there are, say you have a Hilbert space of dimension D, okay? Then you can think of that as just an element of CP D minus 1, because just the component by component in some basis, there's D things. There's D complex numbers. They square to 1, but then the phase doesn't matter. So that gives you CP D minus 1. And the dimensionality of CP D minus 1 is 2D minus 2. So then the sort of the number of states in a Hilbert space of dimension D is 1 over epsilon to the 2D minus 2. Okay. So yeah, now using this formula, we can plug it into here to compute the probability that we're able to do the computation. The result is something that's very small. It's 1 over epsilon to the minus 2 times the size of the computer times the size of the radiation times the size of B times the size of H. These size are dimensionalities, not number of qubits. Let's just be clear. And then plus some subleading stuff. And this is ridiculously small. I mean, making the computer bigger just makes the probability even smaller. So no matter how big your computer is, and no matter how crazily you can prepare the initial state, you're not going to be able to find one that does the computation you want, unless you understand the physics better. You know, unless somehow these randomness assumptions are wrong, which in the case of the circuit model was true because of locality, you're sort of able to have a better handle of what's going on. But if you just you think just some crazy physics you don't understand is going to be able to help you, well, it's probably not. Okay. Moral of the story, the circuit model is good, even if you consider crazy things, which quantum computing people don't usually consider. Okay, I think I've got one more. Excellent. Okay, now another question which is often encountered is, we're saying that it takes exponentially long to make this UR, but that's crazy. The black hole doesn't take that long to make it, right? I mean, the black hole certainly doesn't evolve any exponential timescales. So, I don't know. Can't we just sort of time reverse whatever the black hole did, and in that way do this decoding without having to do one of these complicated constructions? Yeah. What? That's right. This is a bit of ideology about quantum gravity, I guess. But the usual ideology is that from the point of view of someone outside, the dynamics is unitary. So then you could imagine that you send some stuff in, and then stuff you know, later goes out, and that process is unitary. The evidence being that if it weren't true, then you would lose stuff inside of the black hole, and Hawking would be right. So it's definitely, there's ideology going on here that black hole evaporation is a unitary process.
I assume that there's no entanglement between A and B, as you defined before.
Well, good. So yeah, you have to be careful. So A does not appear in this Hilbert space, okay? A appeared in the Hilbert space that I wrote down for Alice. And the relationship between these two theories can be quite subtle. I was going to comment this on the end. So I mean, clearly where I'm going with this is I'm trying to attack that factorization and say that, you know, you're assuming that low energy physics is valid at the level of that factorization is unnecessary because you can't actually test it. You can't actually test the kind of entanglement that people are claiming to get out of this factorization. But then, so what the structure of the Hilbert space should be instead is an interesting question. And it's not one that we took a definite position on. There are various proposals about what could be going on. But maybe just to tide you over, one common proposal is that, the way to actually think about the infalling observer is still in this Hilbert space. But A is actually is equal to R sub B. So the subfactor of the Hilbert space, which looks like it's some diffuse, complicated thing in the radiation from the point of view of someone outside, looks like it's sitting on the other side of the horizon from the point of view of someone inside. And there's no contradiction with that because none of them can ever check the other person's interpretation. Okay? And so then you wouldn't have the paradox because there'd only be two things and they'd just be entangled. And you wouldn't, the A and the RB wouldn't be independent subfactors. Okay. Yeah, and then there'd just be one Hilbert space. The evolution would be unitary. You know, it's the Hilbert space of n equals 4 Supermillan mills, if you like. Okay, good.
It's still confused that 1 over epsilon to the minus 2c. I mean, it's still so counterintuitive. Bigger the computer,
yeah. Yeah, right, it does. So, but the thing is, because usually when you make your computer bigger, you can, because of locality, you don't have to worry that, the case of your computer is interacting with the atoms in the middle of the CPU because of locality. But when you try and make your computer out of some crazy thing like a black hole, you don't really understand whether something like that is happening or not. I mean, probably it's not. I mean, the assumption that went in here was I said, you know, I just said that this U computer is some generic unitary transformation, so that it takes this state that we start with and it just sends it to some random state.
So it's the genericity that basically gives you.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Which of course is, I mean, it's a stupid assumption if you're thinking about, you know, local physics that we understand. But you know, the only reason I went into it is because it seems that local physics that we understand isn't enough to let you do this computation fast. So then people, especially quantum gravity people, often just say, well, just okay, use some physics that you don't understand. But so the point here is just if you try and use physics that you don't understand, it's not clear that it will have the same structure that the circuit model had that makes bigger help you instead of make it worse. Yeah, this is the worst case. That's right. So yeah, the only thing I can say here is that in the worst case scenario, it doesn't help. Yeah. So then there would have to be some special structure which we don't understand in order for something like this to work. Yeah. Okay. So I was talking about how somehow, you know, if the black hole can do this fast, then why can't we do it fast? Okay. So let me say maybe a little bit more about where this state psi actually comes from. So here I just wrote it down. But well, where it actually comes from is that you have some initial state before the black hole was made, let's say. And then there's some U dynamical, which is just the time evolution operator in the theory of quantum gravity. And then it takes that initial state into some state like this. I'll write it more heuristically this time. But now the UR knows about the initial state. That's where the information is about the initial state. It's in which U sub R it is. You know, essentially, what is the purification of B and H? So this U dynamical, of course, doesn't depend on the state. This is just the time evolution operator of the theory. And I think it's reasonable to assume that this U dynamical has a polynomial size circuit for it. This is kind of a, to quantum information people, this is obvious, but it's fairly well understood that simple quantum mechanical systems like, you know, matrix quantum mechanics, multiple particles, in quantum mechanics, and even quantum field theory can be simulated efficiently on quantum computers. So for quantum field theory, it's a little bit surprising, but I guess John Preskill and some of his collaborators have been working on this recently, showing that even in that case, a quantum computer can efficiently compute things from quantum field theory. So I think we'd better take this to be polynomial. And the question is, if this U dynamical is polynomial, does that imply that this URI is also has a polynomial circuit? And well, actually, it almost does. So using this U dynamical and some other simple circuits, you can define an operator. You can define a circuit U tilde R, which acting on the state, let's say dagger, is equal to UR dagger acting on the state, and where this is some polynomial size circuit. So that sounds great. Sounds like we can do the computation fast. But of course, the problem is that this U dynamical doesn't just act on the radiation subfactor. It acts on the whole Hilbert space. And the person, and so therefore, so does this UR and this UR, or UR tilde and this UR tilde dagger. But you know, Charlie or Alice, who's sitting outside of the black hole trying to decode the radiation, doesn't have access to B and H. B and H are still inside of the black hole. So you can't just use this circuit, because the individual gates in this circuit act non-trivially on the parts of the system that you don't have access to. Okay. So that's the thing that prevents you from doing time reversal in some trivial way. And so this again, you know, for people, let's see, what's going on here? I know what I can do. Screen is dark. Oh, okay. Okay, so actually this is pretty similar to this kind of situation where, you know, there's some dynamics in some larger system, but then you don't have access to all of the system and you still want to extract something out of it just with the piece that you do have. Is the thing that's, you know, very familiar, at least to some people here. This is very closely analogous to error correction, quantum error correction. So let me just say very briefly. So what you do when you're doing quantum error correction is you have some system interacting with some environment via some noise, unitary. So the problem is that, you know, you want to extract the state of the system after the noise acts, but you don't have access to the environment. So you can't just apply U noise dagger with your quantum computer and have done with it. So instead, you introduce some ancillary system over here, and then you act with some U correction. And then once that's done, then you want up here to have gotten the original state of the system back. So that's what you do when you're doing quantum error correction in some sort of very formal sense, and it's, you know, it's fairly analogous to what's going on here, although it's not quite exactly the same, because here there's sort of only one state that you're interested in decoding, whereas here usually there's some subspace of things that you'd like, the code subspace, which you'd like to be able to send through and be able to correct, but you can. I won't go through the details now, but there's a simple way to map this problem into a problem that has exactly this structure. Basically, this U noise you can make out of what I called U dynamical, and then this UR dagger is basically like the U correct, which fixes the state. So first of all, it's fairly obvious that for a general U noise, you're not always going to be able to find a U correct that does what you want. I mean, for example, this U noise could just maximally entangle this system with that system. And then no matter what you do up here, you're not able to get the state back. So it's a question, you know, given U noise, is there a U correct? Okay, so this is an interesting question. You know, it's a well-defined computational problem, and I'll use later actually that Patrick and Brian Swingle have shown that this problem is complete in a complexity class which is called QSZK. And then, of course, even after, okay, so given that there is, given correctability, how hard is it? Okay, so even once we know it's correctable, you know, if we know, say we know that U noise is a polynomial size circuit, does that mean that, well, if it's correctable, that U correct is going to be a polynomial size circuit? And the evidence is actually sort of essentially almost overwhelming that the answer is no. So that generically, for generic U noise, that U correct is going to be hard, that you're going to need exponentially many gates to implement it, even if U noise is polynomial size. So I don't think I'm going to be able to give a self-contained explanation of that for people who don't know anything about this. But for people who already know what stabilizer codes are, let me just say very quickly. So stabilizer code is an example of, a stabilizer a code with certain kinds of noise, which basically you can think of as where the errors are just Pauli operators acting on the state, then you can argue that you can argue fairly convincingly that at least the usual way you do error correcting requires exponential time. So okay, the way it works, and again, just sorry for the people who aren't familiar with this. So the number of errors that can happen is 2 to the 2n, because there's 4 different Paulis that can act on each of the n qubits. And then the number of stabilizers is 2 to the n minus k. Where k again, so n and k are as I defined them before. So k is the size of B, and n is the size of the radiation. So when you're doing your error correction, you measure your in the usual way of doing it. You measure the stabilizers, and you get some syndrome of 2 to the n minus k ones and minus ones. But then most of them, most of the errors won't be consistent with the syndrome that you measured. And you can check that, 2 to the 2n divided by 2 to the n minus k, which is 2 to the n plus k, is the number of errors which are consistent with a given syndrome. And then to actually do the correction, you have to figure out, you have to figure out which one of these errors is the most likely one to have happened so that you can correct that one. More carefully, usually the code is degenerate. So then what you really want is this. You write these errors as a coset. So you say there's 2 to the 2k cosets of size 2 to the n minus k. So then that adds up. And then you look for the coset which is most likely. So there's 2 to the 2k cosets. But then in evaluating which coset is most likely, you have to compute the probability of 2 to the n minus k things. And there's a 2 to the n minus k there. So when n is large, that takes exponential time. So that step, at least if you do stabilizer decoding in this way, that step makes it take exponential time. Okay. In general, I mean, in special cases, of course, it can be faster. But at least that shows that in this generic situation, you expect exponential time, even if the circuit here is quite simple. I mean, for the stabilizer codes, the encoding circuit, there's an n squared to encode the code, and then you know these Pauli errors. Can be quite simple, you know. So of course you could still ask, and maybe I'll let's see. I'll just make a brief comment about this, and then I'll try and wrap up. So you could still worry that this shows that this particular method of doing the decoding is hard, but maybe there could be some other method. Not the usual one, which somehow you could do faster in some situations. So then here I think that's where this this first question gets nice. So Patrick and Brian showed that this first question is hard in this complexity class called QSZ sub K. And they didn't have to use any of this type of construction to do it. They just, because it's a quantum complexity argument instead of a, you know, the arguments here usually end up being classical complexity arguments, and then you have to have a particular decoding strategy in mind. But here, the quantum complexity argument really says that no matter how you do the decoding, it would be pretty surprising if you were able to do it fast, because then it would show that this rather general class could be done in polynomial time. Okay, so that's the end of the part, which some people probably didn't understand. So now let me return to the question of, what could be going on? So, okay, let's say now I've established that extracting this R sub B is hard, that just it can't operationally be done, okay? So then along the lines of this sort of nice slice argument at the beginning, I would say, well, if you can't in principle measure something, if no observer can measure it, then maybe that gives you a little bit more license to play around with the structure of the Hilbert space. I mean, the reason why you might have wanted to really insist on that factorization is that if that factorization weren't true, if there were some weird non-locality going on, you might worry about sort of observable acausality, you know, sending signals from here to there. I mean, you know, if local physics just completely breaks down, then, you know, a lot of crazy things can happen. But if you've got this, you know, if you've got this realization that actually some things in this Hilbert space just can't be tested, then it kind of gives you a little bit of license. You know, you can say, okay, well, maybe I can screw around with those things in such a way that it will prevent me from being forced to the AMPS conclusion that the horizon is not smooth without requiring me to accept some other sort of crazy observable violations of local physics at the same time. So there are sort of two popular options for how this should work. Option number one, people have started calling strong complementarity. So in strong complementarity, the claim is that each observer in this space-time has their own quantum mechanical theory. There's not one Hilbert space in Hamiltonian that's the theory of quantum gravity. Each observer gets their own. And then there are, so Alice has one theory, and Charlie has another. And the only restriction, you know, between the different theories is that they have to agree on things they can both measure. So, because otherwise you would just get into really bizarre things, you know, where they can both measure and they can communicate, but they can't agree about what's happening, and it's just bizarre. So there's some restriction that they have to agree in the overlaps of their two diamonds about things that they can both measure. But then it's fairly clear here that if Alice can't measure this R sub B, then maybe she doesn't have to agree with Charlie about it. Maybe Charlie thinks that R sub B is entangled with B, or that B is entangled with R sub B, but Alice thinks that B is entangled with A, and that's fine, because there's no way that they can compare notes and find that one of them was wrong. So this sort of general type of theory where everyone has their own Hilbert space is something that Tom Banks and Willie Fischler have been arguing for a while, although I would say that they still haven't really turned it into an actual framework, but at least that sort of idea. But I have to say, it's kind of a little bit unpleasant, you know, having you know, grown up in the late 2000s, I'm used to hearing people say things like, oh, ADS-CFT is a complete theory of quantum gravity and anti-de Sitter space. You know, and complete means complete, goddammit, right? I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's complete except for when you jump into the black hole and then you need some other theory that we don't even know about to explain it. Maybe it's true. And, you know, maybe the ADS-CFT dictionary only works for things that happen outside of the horizon. But I think it would be a loss. I mean, you know, it would be tragic. You know, I mean, it would mean giving up something that we thought was true. So then, given that sort of rant, there's a second position, which is usually called standard complementarity, which is that you say that, well, there's only one Hilbert space, and there's one Hamiltonian. And then what happens with these different observers is that, the operators in that Hilbert space have different interpretations according to who's looking at them. So like I said before, you know, so for things that are easily accessible to both, it had better be this, you know, they had better agree about what the operators are. They'll get confused about, you know, making different predictions for the same low energy physics that they can communicate about. But, you know, maybe for these very complicated things, which, you know, say this R sub B, which is, you know, not practically accessible to Alice, it's okay to say, well, okay, there's one operator, but its interpretation is different depending on who's looking at it. And I think that's actually sort of closer to what people had in mind when they were thinking about this stuff 10 years ago, although 15 years ago. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, everyone has their own definition of complementarity and none of them agree. But at least I think that the two things I said here are at least two frameworks that you could try to make more precise. And I think it's very interesting to understand whether either of those frameworks, well, could be made well-defined or in just even consistent. It's not clear. So I think the point of view I'll take in the end is that there's a loophole here that we've identified with their argument. But we don't actually know if there is a consistent theory that takes advantage of that loophole to avoid having firewalls. That we don't know, and I hope we can find out. Of course, even if we find it, you know, there's still the problem that, well, how do we know that that's how our black holes work? And but I guess that's an experimental question. Okay, thanks. Yeah, hey, so, good to see you.
So is it clear that you need to get, you know, the state at some late time and then figure out how to decode it? Is it not something that you could do as, you know, the system evolves? So for example, I start with my collapsing object and mm-hmm. I know what state it's in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to collapse and
yeah.
Hawking radiation turns on.
Yeah.
And probably that even turns on before you get to the horizon. There's some ramp up to it as you
know, yeah.
the geometry starts to evolve with time.
Yeah.
And so I could collect the first Hawking photon. Okay, now I can figure out this really simple system of, you know, how my initial state got scrambled into these two different, you know,
yeah.
two different factors, and then kind of slowly build that up.
Yeah, I know that.
I can accomplish that.
Well,
in a reasonable
yeah.
time scale, because then I've got all that whole collapse time, you know, from when the first Hawking photon comes out until it evaporates. To
yeah, no, the short answer is no. Well, first of all, I should say that the collapse time is still only of order m cubed, so compared to exponential things, this won't help you very much. But I think the real problem with what you're saying is that, you know, when the black hole is young, we're in this other situation where the radiation is very small, and most of the Hilbert space is in B and H. Which means that the purification of the thing that you're interested in is not yet in R. So no matter how much you play around with R, you're not really going to be able to get any information about what's going on with these modes. So you've got to wait until it evaporates long enough that the information starts getting into R before you can do the computation. But I mean, of course, yeah. It's of course an idealization to imagine. You know, you've got these slices going on, and then suddenly, bang! You do this whole thing, you know. Of course, you would try and, you would have to sort of do it step by step, but I don't think it would help you. Yeah, I think you would still you'd have a big problem before you could do anything useful. Yeah.
So, being able to decode the information and completely extract the H here is a very strong requirement. I mean, certainly from the stuff you're saying at the very end about, well, you can't measure the same thing,
mm-hmm.
it seems like you might just ask for something weaker, that you know, that there's not even a single observable that somebody on R could measure that would.
Yeah.
Is that right, or is it?
No, yeah, I think so. I mean, if you could test the entanglement in some simpler way, then that would be fine, but it's kind of, I mean, it's hard for me to see how if you have only access to this, you know, if you have access to these two things, how you would be able to test the entanglement. I mean, you could, okay, you don't really need to get UR exactly right. I mean, for example, you only want it up to some unitary acting on these things, but that doesn't help very much. So I don't know if there's a, I mean, yeah, that would be great if there was some simple thing you could check without, having to be able to somehow implicitly use UR dagger somewhere. But I couldn't come up with anything. I mean, I tried a couple of different things.
Well, I don't know of anything simple, but the point is that it's in principle simpler. I mean, that it's a smaller thing to test. And, but I guess the real question is, what would constitute, if you could measure something, what would constitute a problem? If you could measure anything, or would it have to be like some entanglement witness, or what?
Entanglement witness was what I had in mind. I'm not completely sure. You know, the problem with answering this question is that, in the end, with you know these thought experiments, I mean, we don't really think that the laws of physics are going to be that like, in the Lagrangian, there's some you know theta function that says if you can do this, then that term; if you can't, then that. So somehow we're just trying to motivate what the structure of the Hilbert space might be, and I don't really. You know, I mean, like, say, I don't know. Say that you could test the entanglement with probability, you know, e to the minus 20 or something. You know, I mean, probably that would be, you know, there's something you can do with just, you know, with that probability checks it for you. You know, you could probably do that shorter, but then, I mean, okay, I don't know if I should worry about that. I mean, you can't distinguish that from just some random fluctuation or something.
So e to the minus 20 here is supposed to be.
Oh, I just. I meant it to scale with n. Yeah, if it's some constant, that's probably fine. I think it better scale with n. I should say, I wasn't very clear about the sizes of these things, but I think, you know, when you do these black hole thought experiments, I think the right limit to take is you fix your size in Planck units, and then you consider the black hole to be large in Planck units, sort of parametrically large, and then you just study how things scale in that limit is the only thing that really means anything. Because that, I mean, that's because for any reasonable black hole, that parameter is so large that you can just forget anything else. I mean, this n already, for a solar mass black hole, this n is something like 10 to the 80 or something. So it's just. Yeah.
If you were done with that.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between this and. I didn't see anything in your argument, like I missed it, about the black hole in particular. I mean, what's the difference if I say that I do this versus burning an encyclopedia?
Good. Yeah. So, right. The difference is that here there's a fundamental limitation on how much time you have available to do it, right? When you burn an encyclopedia, I mean, okay, well, okay.
For the outsiders?
What?
For the outside?
No, for the person who's going in. I mean, the person who's outside can do this, okay? I mean, no matter how long it is. I mean, provided we don't want to bring cosmology into it, which I don't want to do. but the difference is that when you have a black hole, there's really a limitation. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's there and you just, you know, you die before you can look at it. I mean, well, actually you do, but it's like there's no chance of you not dying. Because once you're behind the horizon, you've just only got, you know, order m, or order root n time left available to you.
We get into a zone of ignorance, but
what?
We get into a zone of ignorance, but
yeah. I mean, look, I'm not declaring that I have a theory where all of this is definitely what happens, right? I mean, this is the goal here is to just sort of figure out what the properties might be of a theory that is able to have a smooth horizon with unitarity without anything else terrible happening. But I mean, even if I can come up with something, that might not be what actually happens, right?
Okay, let's thank Daniel again.